This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. We're moving into the past in two different directions in today's program. In the first half of the program, I'm going to be talking with Bill Boyarsky, a veteran reporter for various California newspapers, including a reporting team that won three Pulitzer Prizes for the Los Angeles Times. He's written a new book, Big Daddy, Jesse Unruh and the Art of Power Politics, about the Speaker of the Assembly in the 50s, late 50s, 60s, and then later California State Treasurer. And in the second half of the program, I'm going to be talking with Ruth Ann Lum McCunn, a novelist best known for 1,000 Pieces of Gold, who's just written a new novel, God of Luck, having to do with Chinese laborers kidnapped and taken to work in the guano pits in Peru in the 1900s. She'll be at the Gold Mountain Tea Shop in Nevada City at 7 p.m. this Saturday. But first, Bill Boyarsky. It's very interesting. I get a number of books from University of California Press, and in last year, I received California Rising, The Life and Times of Pat Brown, and I passed it up because I thought, well, I already don't know this, and most of us know this, too. This year, as soon as I saw a mention of Big Daddy, I jumped on it. I thought, this is something I really want to read, and this is somebody I really want to find out about. Is that been your experience?
Well, yes, it is, actually. I was, when I started to work on this book, and while I was doing my research and my writing, it occurred to me often who would be interested in the life story of a long dead political leader and whose name is fallen beneath the cracks today. And I know I teach at USC, and my students, of course, have never heard of him. When I told them I'm writing a book, I have to explain. So that was my thought, I'm surprised at the very positive reception it's received. It received page one reviews in the Chronicle and the Los Angeles Times, with big pictures on the cover, which is very encouraging. We've had two book events down here, which were absolutely packed, and books were sold out at each one, and we've been checking Amazon, and we're doing quite well. So I am really surprised and, of course, pleased at the interest that this book is generated.
I may be particularly interested because I moved to California permanently in 1967 when he was still very much in the center of California politics. Mm-hmm. And Brown, Edmund Brown, the senior, had just left the stage, essentially.
Yes, he had. Well, in 1966, Brown, Governor Edmund G. Brown, had been defeated by Ronald Reagan in quite a landslide. And so Unruh remained Speaker of the Assembly, the Democrats retaining control of the legislature of the Assembly. And so then Unruh, for at least that year, was sort of head-to-head with Reagan. But not really, because by that time, by 1967, sort of late into the year and into 1968, Unruh was planning on leaving the Assembly to run for governor. And then in 1968, the Republicans took control of the Assembly, and Unruh lost his speakership, and his power was really diminished, and he was on his way to run for governor.
When I moved here, he had the reputation of being sort of a local LBJ, the sort of person who knew where all the levers of power were and knew how to get almost anything through, but was not just a cynical politician, also had some deeply felt social goals he wanted to attain.
He was very much shaped by the extreme poverty of his Texas sharecrop youth. He came west to California in the late 30s, as part of that generation of Southwesterners from Oklahoma, Texas, and Arkansas, all of them known derisively as Okies, who came here to California and really changed, were a powerful force in the political culture. So he was part of that. So his years of poverty never really left him. So while he used power and he obtained power by very rough methods, I mean, nobody better have stood in his way. The thing about him, he used that power to help people. I thought as I was writing the book, there was the good Unruh and the bad Unruh, two contrasting sides of this man, which made the work on it so fascinating.
The picture that accompanies the review in the Chronicle of 2 weeks ago shows sort of the bad Unruh in a sense. This is after he's lost some weight because he got a little ashamed of always being called Big Daddy, but he's very determined and very much in control of the room he's in, which I assume is the Assembly.
Yeah.
But on the cover of your book, you have him before he lost all his weight, also definitely in the Assembly, but this time he looks just as pleased as he could possibly be with the way things are going.
He was, and you know, he hated the name of Big Daddy, but you know, when he was big, when I first met him in 1961, when I started at the Capitol, covering the Capitol for the Associated Press, he was really big, and he was very intimidating. I mean, especially to a young, inexperienced reporter like me. I mean, he was big, and then he lost all that weight in 65, 66, 67, that period, and actually wasn't as scary as he used to be.
But he looked...
To me, anyway.
Yeah, he looks scarier to everyone else.
Well, he's a tough guy, you know, and he had... He could really read into the heart of a person. I mean, his eyes could sort of see right into you, and he was able to sense people's innermost thoughts and fears and hopes. Lyndon Johnson was like that, by the way, and when you point out the resemblance between these two Texans, you know, I think you're definitely on the right track, because they had a lot in common. I mean, they were the Texas, their love of power, their populism, their paranoia, you know, everything. It was all there. Their rising from the bottom, although LBJ did not come from a family that was anywhere near as poor as Unruh.
The other person you compare him with is Bill Clinton, and certainly for their intelligence. Well, I think all three of them were the sort who had the sort of intelligence you wonder how it came from people in their circumstances, but they were usually the smartest people in their crowds from school days.
Well, that's right. He was all three of them were the smartest people in their class, and Clinton was, you know, and you know, not only in Arkansas but at Yale, and you know, as he moved on in life, and LBJ certainly, there weren't very many people smarter than him, and Unruh too. I mean, they were all very determined to succeed. The reason I compared them to Bill Clinton, however, wasn't their personalities or their brains. I mean, they were both smart. Clinton has a charismatic personality. I mean, he dominates a room. He's a marvelous person, public speaker. Unruh was none of that. So, but what struck me about the comparison of them two is they both represented the broad center of the Democratic Party. You know, the party that, as you trace its history from the end of World War II through the Cold War, up to today, you have a split between the center of the party, as represented by Clinton and the Democratic Leadership Council, the centrists, and then you have the party's more liberal or left wing, which was during the post-war period, not an enthusiastic Cold Warrior. They were not enthusiastic Cold Warriors. They were anti-communist, but they were more interested in a détente. And Unruh was an unreconstructed Cold Warrior. So you had that split, and it continues in the party today. And certainly, that's what's tugging at Hillary Clinton. Campaign for the presidency and for the other Democratic candidates. On one hand, they don't want to appear weak. They don't want to appear like they want to surrender in Iraq. But on the other hand, the party's left is determined that we pull out immediately. And so you have it's this historic clash within the Democratic Party, and Unruh was very much part of the center of that party.
Where I would differ with you on that, and where I think the comparison with LBJ comes a little closer than with Clinton, is that Unruh and LBJ both knew how to get things done, and I have the impression that Clinton knew how to get elected, but not necessarily how to get his programs through without compromising them, to my mind, fatally.
Well, in a sense, that's right. But the thing about LBJ and Unruh and the centrists was that they both actually were compromisers to get things through. I mean, certainly LBJ in getting what I think is his greatest accomplishment, the Voting Rights Act, through, had to deal with the Southerners and with the Republicans, and Unruh had to deal with, in his own civil rights legislation, had to deal the same. I was going to call this book the Politics, the Art of the Possible. Politics are the art of the possible, and Bismarck said that many years ago, and that certainly was what governed Unruh, was that that he would rather do what was possible than to march off with flags flying and the cheers of his liberal supporters and then lose.
Can you tell us a little more about the Unruh Civil Rights Act? That's something that probably most of our listeners know almost nothing about.
Well, some may know nothing about it, and some may owe a great deal to it. The Unruh Civil Rights Act was passed in 1959, was authored by Unruh and written by his chief aide, Marvin Hoelen, and it was passed before Unruh was the speaker. He was a powerful assemblyman, but not yet the speaker. It outlawed discrimination by any business of any kind whatsoever. And those were the words in the law. Well, when this bill passed, Unruh had to use all of his muscle to get it passed. The conservative Senate was ready to kill it, and Unruh had to threaten to kill all of the Senate bills that session. And finally, the Senate unlocked it and let it pass and butchered it and amended it. But that key phrase, businesses of any kind whatsoever, remained in the bill. And it passed. And over the years, that language was expanded by the courts to include all kinds of businesses, from real estate to, to bowling alleys to retail stores. All of them were covered by this act. And subsequent legislatures and the courts expanded the scope of the bill. It originally applied to minorities, but it was expanded to first to include the disabled and then to include gays and lesbians. And so today, all over the state, in courtrooms all over the state, people or victims of discrimination are going to court and suing under the Unruh Act. It probably was his greatest legacy.
And that was even before he became a speaker.
This was before he became speaker. And untold numbers of people use this act every day to fight discrimination.
You mentioned that he used one of his favorite techniques, which was to essentially tell the Senate that none of their bills would pass if they didn't pass his.
Right. That's what he did. He came back from lunch one day, and he'd had a few drinks at lunch, and his secretary told him that the Senate was sitting on this bill and would not schedule it for a hearing, the Senate committee. And he said, hold all the Senate bills, all of them, everyone. And he held them up. And then, and these were a lot of bills that were important to the senators. Some were of high policy. Some were, little pork barrel bills that were very important to their district.
And he was able to do this even with no official position.
Well, he was the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee.
That's
and every
right.
important piece of legislation had to go through this committee, which was basically the fiscal committee of the assembly. So any kind of bill that in any way had any money connected with it, even remote, would have to go through this committee. And as the chairman, he just held them all up.
One of the things that interests me about your book is that you go into great detail on three or four specific pieces of legislation and electoral campaigns and so on, but you never really mention his selection as a Speaker of the Assembly, more or less as if it was a formality, that he already had the power before he got that title.
Well, somebody else pointed that out to me after the book came out, and as I thought about it, I think I should have devoted not a whole chapter, because he had gathered so much power that his election as speaker was a formality. But I should have devoted more space to how he gathered that power, to specifically him gathering that power for that particular election.
His other main achievement that you talk about is transforming the California legislature from a part-time, poorly paid, amateurish organization that was easily swayed by lobbyists to a full-time, well-staffed professional organization. But then you mentioned that it's still easily swayed by lobbyists.
Well, that's the that's right. That's sort of the sad end to the story. He felt that a full-time legislature with a full-time professional staff could match wits and power with the executive branch and with the lobbyists and be a dominant force. And he also wanted a full-time legislature because he wanted a full-time job. I mean, he was living on the salary of a part-time legislator. He didn't have a law practice. He wasn't a lawyer. He had a consulting business, but the business kind of was on the edge. In other words, some of its clients had business before the legislature, and so that made him nervous. He wanted a full-time job for himself, and he also believed that a full-time legislature would be good. And so he put together this campaign, and he got the two candidates for governor, Ronald Reagan and Pat Brown, to endorse it, and the voters approved the idea of the full-time legislature. Now, unfortunately, you know, there's a way around all reforms. I think now, looking at it, it's very hard, if not impossible, to take special interest money, that is money from corporations, businesses, unions that have business with the state, out of politics. The only possible way would be public financing of political campaigns, which I don't think the voters would ever approve of. Money finds its way into politics, and that's very true. The same corporate interests that have dominated Sacramento for years, and the same labor interests that have dominated Sacramento for years are still in power.
Nonetheless, Unruh assembled quite a team of associates, and maybe things would have worked better if he had stuck around to be able to carry it out the way he foresaw it. Do you think there's any chance of that?
Well, I think that I think when he lost the speakership in 1968, when the Republicans took over, I think a speaker job has a limit. I mean, it's not a lifetime job. His great ambition in life was to be governor. That was his ambition. And that's what he wanted to do. He didn't want to stick around. He couldn't have stuck around.
But his campaign for governor was one of his clumsiest.
Well, it was a loser from the beginning. He had in 1968 and late in 1967, he had broken with President Johnson over the Vietnam War, where once Unruh had been a supporter of the Vietnam War, he turned against it. And he was also wanted desperately to get Robert Kennedy, who was also moving toward opposition to the war, into the race to run for president. And that occupied his attention. Now, President Johnson had the levers of power, you know, all of the money people in the party, particularly, and including all of those in Southern California, were very loyal to him. So when Unruh broke with Johnson and supported Kennedy for president, that meant that the Democratic money was denied him. And so he, in 1970, when he ran for governor, he had very little money. He couldn't afford television, and he was expected to lose by a million votes or so. Actually, it didn't turn out that way. In the last months of the campaign, California sunk into a recession, especially in Southern California and in the San Francisco Bay Area, an aerospace recession, and lines were incredible around the unemployment offices. I remember seeing them, and his campaign sort of caught fire, and he lost by 500,000 or so votes, but he cut down the margin so much that the Democrats regained control of the state assembly.
And then a few years later, he returned as state treasurer, which was an easy election to win because nobody paid too much attention to it.
And he had the best name. He had the best known name.
And how did he do once he became treasurer?
Well, it was a very interesting period in his life. In many ways, most interesting. He took an office that was really obscure and had no power, and he immediately saw where the power was and began to change things drastically. One thing he did was that he saw that when he became treasurer in 1974-75, there was a tremendous housing slump in California in residential housing. Financing had was dried up. Does that sound familiar? And what he did was he supported and he created a state agency that would issue bonds, and these bonds would raise money and give the money to the savings and through savings and loans would issue mortgages, low-cost mortgages, and it really stimulated housing. That worked so well that this sort of financing was extended to hospitals, to private universities, these boards issuing bonds, and it really resulted in quite a bit of construction. These bonds were all sold by big bond houses on Wall Street, and so Unruh, of course, was able to squeeze campaign contributions out of these bond houses for himself, and raised a lot of money for his own campaigns, and they wined him and dined him. But he also squeezed something else out of these bond houses. He, like, for instance, with health care, if he'd give a bond house permission to work on a big bond issue for a hospital down in Southern California, he also required him to sell bonds for small health clinics and small hospitals in the Central Valley or places like that where there were a lot of poor people. And, you know, up and down the California, they still exist today, these small health facilities that were built by because of Unruh's squeezing the bond companies. They're another memento of of his power.
The one thing he couldn't handle was dying, but he, in a sense, chose to die rather than live on in a way he would have found unacceptable.
Well, he had prostate cancer, and this was in the 1980s, and the treatment for prostate cancer was not anywhere near as advanced as it is today, and the alternatives were fairly limited, and one of them, and the one that most people used, was the removal of the prostate. And at that time, with that operation meant usually, not all the time, but usually, or often anyway, meant that a man would be rendered impotent and incontinent, but impotent. Unruh loved women. His life was, his search for women was a just part of his life. And for him to be, as I wrote, to be impotent in anything, in sex and politics and life, was beyond his, he wouldn't tolerate that. And so he did not have that operation, and the cancer spread, and he died.
But that was his choice.
That was his choice, right.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I've been talking with Bill Boyarsky, author of Big Daddy, Jesse Unruh, and The Art of Power Politics, that has just been released by University of California Press. And it gives you a wonderful glimpse of a time not too far back, but one that most of us have forgotten. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. A author who has had quite a resonance with the local area is Ruth Ann Lum McCunn, the author of a number of novels and nonfiction books for adults and children, primarily for adults, but the overlap is quite interesting. She's best known for her novel, Thousand Pieces of Gold, from about 20 years ago. Well, a little more than that. I remember selling it when I was selling new books in the late 70s. And also Wooden Fish Songs, another novel also based on real Chinese-American experience. That tends to be her main area of focus, which was performed as a spoken, as a not staged, but as a reader's theater production by Community Asian Theater of the Sierra 10 years ago in 1997. Her latest book is God of Luck, and Katz will be bringing her up to sign and discuss the book this Saturday at the Golden Mountain Tea Shop on Broad Street in Nevada City. It'll be Saturday at 7 p.m. Welcome to Booktown, Ruth Ann.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This is a fascinating book. I discovered that I have a tendency to feature books about Chinese Americans more than most people probably would, but I've always found my choices quite well repaid. And this one, which describes things I knew almost nothing about, is both fascinating and very moving. It has to do with a Chinese from the Pearl River Basin, the area around Canton or Guangzhou, who was kidnapped and taken to the islands where guano was being mined, or really just dug up from the surface in the mid-1900s. And we know a fair amount about what happened to Chinese in North America, very little about what happened to them in South America. Is this just a natural extension of your earlier interests?
Yes, I think so. And as you say, it's a area that hasn't been much touched upon in either nonfiction or fiction. And so it was an area that I felt should be better known than it is. I should say here in the West, because in China, it is still very well remembered.
Especially because so many people from that area were taken.
Right, and of course it had a lasting emotional impact too, because the men were kidnapped and brought to not just Peru, but all of Latin America, the Caribbean, and Cuba to essentially replace African slave labor, because this was a trade that took place after the Atlantic slave trade was outlawed.
And you say that of probably a million were kidnapped in all, and 100,000 of them went to Peru?
Yes, that's the estimate.
The book that I immediately came to mind while I was reading this was Charles Johnson's Middle Passage. And I found this much more graphic, I guess I'd say, compelling, perhaps because I knew nothing about it. But the situation, this, I don't know, want to give too much away, but there is a mutiny on board, and one of the Chinese says, one of the ones who seems to know more about what's happening, says that there's almost always a mutiny on these ships going from China to Peru, but they very rarely succeed. This one almost succeeds, but not quite.
Right. And as you note, there are many parallels to the Middle Passage for African Americans. And one of the reasons why there were so many mutinies is that, as I noted, the African slave trade had been outlawed. And so this was supposed to be a traffic in free labor. That's why, even though the men were kidnapped, they were coerced, forced, tortured into signing labor contracts. And they also were not shackled as Africans were for the Middle Passage. So even though they were packed into the ships very much like the Africans were, because they weren't shackled, at least not initially on the voyage, they were able to bring about mutiny.
And the ship owners seemed to take this as a matter of course, and things were touch and go for a minute, but they succeeded in putting it down.
Right, because of course the ship owners were prepared and in fact had cannon directed onto the decks where Chinese coming up from the holds would be, and then they could, if Chinese succeeded in coming out of the holds, then the cannon could be shot at them.
In this case, though, they actually managed, it seemed, to overcome the cannon, but then got a little careless, and the crew reasserted their control.
Right, and that was what happened a lot, is that the crews were able to reassert control, and even when the captives were able to get the ship back to China, very often they would just simply be offloaded onto another vessel that was headed for Latin America.
And there seemed to have been quite a few double and triple agents working. Not all of the Chinese were actually enslaved. Some of them were essentially, I wouldn't quite call them shills, but they were there to direct the people who were enslaved in the direction the owners wanted them to go. And you could never really tell who you could trust, who was in your situation and who was really on the other side.
Exactly.
The story alternates between Ah Lung, the kidnapped one, and his wife, Bo Si, who stays back in the village. The second story, in addition to how Ah Lung finally succeeds in escaping, is what's happening in the village and how they are trying to figure out if there's some way they can ransom him or redeem him. The family is primarily silkworm cultivators, and a lot of the attention goes to the processes of silkworm cultivation. And in this, it's his wife who is the dominant person. She had almost been forced to become a sworn spinster, and his twin sister, Ah Lung's twin sister, did become a sworn spinster. This is something I'd never heard about.
Yes, actually, it's not. It's another area of Chinese history that is not very well known, and that is that beginning in the 1830s, in this silkworm-producing area of the Pearl River Delta, there were women who resisted marriage and who took vows of independence and then lived in communities of women. And I knew about it because this was actually a tradition that continued for over 100 years. And when I was a girl growing up in Hong Kong, there were still many sworn spinsters at that time. They were working as servants in Hong Kong, but I always had great admiration for them because their independence just shone through, and it seemed to me that they were actually freer and had better lives than the women that they were working for. Who were married and had to obey their husbands.
The sister, Ah Lung's sister, goes to Canton, where she essentially becomes a hairdresser, but manages to accumulate a tidy amount of money on her own, as well as a great deal of freedom. And then Bo Si, the wife, is the one who best knows how to take care of silkworms more than anybody else. And at first, other people mock her, but she manages to get her techniques carried through by her family, and they even use this to raise enough money that they think they can use to ransom Ah Lung. Is that realistic also?
Yes. I mean, the silk industry flourished at that time, and it was really because of the industry that provided a possibility for economic independence that women in the area, there was no such thing as bound feet, and it was what really enabled them to become independent spinsters. And I actually explored this in an earlier book, The Moon Pearl, just how the whole tradition of independent spinsterhood came about. But it's not at all unrealistic to for the family to be able to try and effect a ransom. Whether a ransom could succeed is, of course, a whole different thing.
To get more into the women of this time, they did not have to have their feet bound.
Well, no, because the hours in the silkworm house, raising silkworms is very time-consuming, and it requires very long hours, especially initially because silkworms are very greedy and need to be fed almost constantly when they're first hatched. And so that required long hours on one's feet. So no foot binding.
In modern Chinese silk establishments, you'll see a number of workers dressed in like almost surgical white costumes unraveling the silk from various worms. It seems a very relaxed and pretty slow-moving process. I guess this is far from how it originally was.
Yeah, it wasn't relaxed at all. It was very intense, in fact, and the unraveling of the silk from the cocoons was also concentrated work, and because you have to have the cocoons in boiling water in order to loosen the strands of silk in order to then reel them. So the reeling process was very complex and challenging.
And Bo Xi, the wife, is the one who has more understanding of how to deal with the worms than anyone else. She's very, although the process is still intense, she's very calm and slow-moving and is very concerned that none of the worms get injured. Apparently, I guess you said they're greedy, they can get so greedy that they trample each other on their way to food.
Exactly.
And in the end, in here, she devises a new method. They already had seven generations per year, but they come up with the extra money for the ransom by inducing an eighth generation, which she first manages to do by carrying the silk eggs, the worm eggs, around close to her body, almost acting as an incubator. Is this something you have historical knowledge of?
Oh, yes. That was something that was done actually in a part of China that was also well known for raising silk, but which had a cooler climate than the Pearl River Delta. And so there, initially, in the spring, if somebody wanted to hurry up the process of getting the generations of worms hatched, then they would hatch the eggs against their bodies to use the body heat to generate sufficient warmth for the worms to hatch. But of course, you know, just having money isn't sufficient for ensuring freedom, because actually many of the men who were kidnapped for this trade came from wealthy families. In the West, the trade is called the coolie trade, implying that only the poor were swept up in these raids, but that was not the case. And so money is not enough, and that's, of course, one of the reasons why the book is titled God of Luck, because it really, whether the couple ever are able to reunite or not, is up to the God of Luck.
You even mentioned that the particular owner who had theoretically contracted Ah Lung was known for his cruelty, and if they had tried to ransom him, he might have just refused out of cruelty.
Yes, the Guano Islands, there's actually quite a bit that was written about the Guano Islands and how they were run and so on. And this particular person who ran the island that Ah Lung was on was renowned for his cruelty.
You are of Scottish and Chinese ancestry. You were born in the U.S. in San Francisco's Chinatown, then moved to Hong Kong when you were very young, which seems to be the opposite of the process most people do.
Right.
How did that come about?
Well, my mother was from Hong Kong, and she had come to America and met my father at the World's Fair in San Francisco. My mother and a cousin came to San Francisco to go to the World's Fair. And so after my mother met my father and they fell in love and got married, it was just about coincidentally about the time that World War II broke out. And so during the war, Hong Kong was occupied by the Japanese, so there was almost no contact between my mother and her family during that time, and my father went to sea. So my mother felt very isolated in San Francisco, and after the war was over, Hong Kong was free once more, my father and mother agreed that she would take my sister and myself to Hong Kong to live with her family, and so that she wouldn't be as lonely.
But then you eventually returned to the U.S.
I came to America to go to college.
And you've never left?
Well,
I mean, you travel. It's obvious you
travel. Right. But no, I've never left. I've made my home here back in San Francisco, in fact, over the last 30 years.
And for the last 25 or so of these, you've been writing both fiction, and also you're very involved with Chinese American history.
Yes, I am, and it seems like many of my books start in China and end up in America, too. So even though all of my books are about other people and set in the 19th century, somehow I seem to be recreating my own journey in some ways.
Have you ever thought of doing a 20th century story?
I actually did one. Well, more than one, actually. I have a book, Chinese American Portraits, which profiles about 18 different Chinese Americans, and some of those stories take place in the 20th century. And also, I have a book, Soul Survivor, which tells the true story of Poon Lim, who holds the world record for survival at sea. and he earned that record when he was on a raft for 133 days after his ship was torpedoed during World War II. But of course, if you're out in the middle of an ocean and on a raft, it doesn't matter what century you're in. So I don't really, even though that book obviously takes place in the 20th century, it could be any century.
And it seems that you have a particular fondness for the 19th.
I do.
Any particular reasons?
I think, I grew up in Hong Kong in the 1940s and 50s when Hong Kong was still, was not yet the modern city that it is today and has been for over half a century now. But when I was growing up, we didn't have plumbing. We lived very 19th century lives in many ways. So it's a real comfort zone area for me.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm talking with Ruth Ann Lum McCunn, mostly about her new book, God of Luck, a novel that was recently published by Soho. She's going to be appearing this coming Saturday at the Golden Mountain Tea Shop on Broad Street in Nevada City, 7 p.m. for a book signing. And are you going to read, discuss?
Yes, I will. I will be reading and discussing God of Luck, but I'll also be talking about The Moon Pearl because of the sworn spinsters that occur in both books, and I'll probably talk some about Wooden Fish Songs as well.
I just talked yesterday evening with Jeannie Wood, the executive director of Community Asian Theater of the Sierra, and she said they are thinking of a revival of Wooden Fish Songs sometime, either as a reader's theater or maybe as a full-blown production.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
But I guess they would have to adapt it.
Well, the it's already adapted for the concert reading. It is not adapted for a full staged show.
Well, that might happen, or I don't know what exactly will happen, but they would. They say they have been frequently asked to have something they can take on the road, something that they can present around California, around the West, and that seems like, in some ways, the perfect vehicle.
It is, and in fact, we, my husband, who was in theater, and I, we did go on the road with a concert reading of Wooden Fish Songs all through the Pacific, through the East Coast, from the Northeast down to, all the way down to Florida, actually, and then also in Hawaii and the greater Bay Area.
Well, I've got to get off now, but I'll remind our listeners again that Ruth Ann Lum McCunn will be at the Golden Mountain Tea Shop on Broad Street in Nevada City, 7 p.m. this Saturday, to read from, discuss, and sign her latest book, God of Luck. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Stay tuned for Jimmy Acardi's Rock and Roll Party.